You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgain. The USDA has made some serious financial help available for small farmers and producers interested in boosting their income with value-added products. The Value-Added Producer Grant Program will award up to $75,000 for planning grants and up to $200,000 for working capital grants. This morning, Melanie Drexel, a senior loan specialist for USDA Rural Development, has some details about the program and the application process. Good morning, Melanie. Let's start with, what is a value-added product and how can this grant help small producers in our area?
Well, the program came about in the last Farm Bill, so it was implemented by Congress. And the purpose of the program is to increase farmers' income through processing, sale, and sale of value-added products. So a value-added product would refer to taking a raw commodity and then turning it into something more valuable. For example, making jam from berries or making cheese out of milk. For fishing and forestry, those are also eligible activities. If for a harvester, which would be a logger or a fisherman, they need to demonstrate they have the legal right to harvest that product. And then the value-added product, for example, might be wood chips or pellets, mulch, lumber, something that they would make out of that raw product. For fishing, they might make smoked fish or some sort of salad or soup or something. Just the value-added concept is just making something more valuable out of that raw product, with the goal being that they would earn more money selling the value-added product than selling the raw commodity.
For those who have a good idea of a value-added product they might want to produce, what kind of help is available and for what purposes can the grant funds be used?
Well, there are criteria for the grant. It is a grant program. The funds can be used for planning or for working capital. Planning grants can be made for up to $75,000, and those funds can be used for feasibility studies, market studies, and marketing plans. Those studies need to be prepared by an independent third party. They're designed to help determine if there is a market for the product and if the product will turn a profit. Then there is also a working capital grant that can be made for up to $200,000. Funds may be used for labor, utilities, packaging, labeling, supplies, advertising, and other expenses related to the production and marketing of the value-added product, but cannot be used for things like land, buildings, and equipment.
So you wouldn't be able to fund a truck to take your produce to market.
Right.
How difficult is the paperwork process, and do you have to be familiar with the grant writing process?
We have an application toolkit that is designed to help a person through it. We'll ask questions, for instance, and then they check a box or write an answer. So it's designed to go through all the criteria required and then prompt people to provide the correct information.
Can the toolkit be accessed online?
Yes, it is online on our USDA website. You can find it there at USDA.gov, and then you will need to do some searching around. Or they can call me. And I would be happy to send them and respond with an email with the link in it and some other helpful information. I would like to mention also that there is a one-to-one match requirement, which means that the grant funds have to be matched with an equal amount of cash or eligible in-kind contributions. Examples would be applicant cash, bank loans, the value of the applicant or family member's labor, third-party contributions, and the value of the raw commodity itself can be included.
How long is the grant program going, and can you give some examples of some small producers who have benefited from the program?
Well, it's been about 5 years because it was done with the last farm bill. And as you know, the new farm bill is under consideration by Congress at this time. And I expect that the program will be continued. There have been a number of local farmers in the area that I am in, which is Mount Vernon, Washington, who have successfully used the program. One is a dairy farmer who has a herd of Jersey cows. They were selling the raw milk. Now they are processing the milk on their farm through a low-heat pasteurization process, bottling it on the farm, and selling the finished product. And they make different kinds of milk. They make whole, skim, low-fat chocolate milk, eggnog during the Christmas season. And that has been a very good example of a successful project. We had another one where an orchard making vodka out of their apples, and another orchard making cider out of their apples. We have a potato farmer who recently completed a feasibility study through the grant program to look into the feasibility of making vodka out of potatoes. So we've done a number. It is a great program. It's very interesting to see what people are doing with their different products that they raise.
Well, to wrap up, could you give details of the workshop in Chehalis next Tuesday?
Right, that's January 14th from 9 to noon at the Service Center in Chehalis. And for your listeners in Oregon, there is a contact that I would like to give you for the Oregon State Office of USDA Rural Development. His name is Martin Zone, and his phone number is 503-414-3361. In Washington State, they can contact me. My name is Melanie Drexel at 360-428-4322, extension 158.
Thank you, Melanie Drexel, for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Melanie Drexel, Senior Loan Specialist for USDA Rural Development. You can find a link to the Value Added Producer Grant Program on our website, coastradio.org, under Programs, The Bridge. Next up, 23 years ago, the listing of the northern spotted owl under the Endangered Species Act was one of the factors that led to a sharply reduced northwest timber harvest. Now, wildlife officials are proposing to list the Oregon spotted frog. If approved, this listing would not have nearly the far-reaching impact the spotted owl listing had. But as Leah Moriarty reports, officials in Oregon's Klamath County are pushing back against a proposal they fear will lead to intrusive and economically damaging regulations.
It probably doesn't help that the frog at the center of this controversy has the word spotted in its name. Recently on JPR's Jefferson Exchange, Klamath County Commissioner Tom Malams cited the spotted owl listing as a cautionary tale.
It's decimated the entire state timber industry. Billions and billions of dollars lost in the economic drivers and thousands of jobs lost, entire communities decimated.
The decline of the Northwest timber economy can't really be blamed solely on the spotted owl. Economic trends, including mechanization and dwindling old-growth forests, had been reducing logging jobs well before the owl became a regional celebrity. But as a symbol of government overreach in the name of environmental protection, the spotted owl resonates deeply in resource-dependent communities such as Klamath County. And Commissioner Malams says he and his colleagues are determined to resist what they see as a system that values critters above humans.
I think the balance of this whole equation has been totally lost, whether you're talking about the spotted owl, spotted frog, or wolf, or whatever it is. The balance needs to get swung back to the place where there's some economic driving forces going on to help our community survive.
Malams quotes a California judge who once described the U.S. Department of the Interior as rife with environmental zealots with an agenda. Noah Greenwald's take on federal wildlife agencies is strikingly different. Greenwald is with the Center for Biological Diversity, a Tucson-based nonprofit that's frequently sued those agencies for not using the Endangered Species Act aggressively enough. For Greenwald, the listing of the Oregon spotted frog is 20 years overdue.
It's an aquatic species. It's dependent on river floodplains, areas that pool up, kind of wetlands next to rivers. And, you know, as you can well imagine, that's a habitat type that's been heavily degraded.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates the spotted frog is gone from more than three-quarters of its historic habitat, which used to extend from Northern California to British Columbia. Now it exists in fragmented populations, mostly in Oregon and Washington. The Center for Biological Diversity sued the Fish and Wildlife Service when it declined to list the spotted frog after first proposing it in 1993. The current spotted frog proposal is part of a settlement in which the government has promised to complete vetting hundreds of candidate species by 2018. On the Jefferson Exchange, Greenwald said the listings should be welcomed, not feared.
These species are part of the ecosystem. They're part of the web of life. And their ecosystems provide us services. You know, they provide us protection from flooding. They clean our water. They pollinate our plants. And so as we lose species, these ecosystems lose their function, and that will ultimately affect us all.
Of the 54,000 acres being considered for designation as critical habitat for the spotted frog, more than half are in Klamath County. Jennifer O'Reilly is a biologist with the Fish and Wildlife Service in Bend. She says private landowners needn't worry if their property is included in the areas designated as critical frog habitat.
One of the things we tell people that specifically with critical habitat, that it's not a refuge or a preserve. It does not authorize the federal government, you know, or public access to private land.
One way private landowners could be impacted would be if the use of their land includes federal contracts or permits. The Klamath commissioners worry grazing or logging on federal land could be restricted. But O'Reilly says grazing or logging could actually be used to restore frog habitat by removing invasive vegetation. She says her agency is eager to work with landowners to develop ways to help save the Oregon spotted frog. I'm Liam Moriarty reporting.
Before sunrise every morning, an Olympia, Washington teacher wages a solo fight against invasive English ivy, which has taken over a forest in a nearby city park. His pre-dawn ritual is to yank and hack away at the ivy by the light of a headlamp. It's a seemingly Sisyphean quest. Invasive ivy is a problem in many Northwest cities. Are we winning or losing this battle? Tom Bonsi spoke with Kevin Head about his battle against the invasive weed.
Most of us have a workday morning routine. For some, a stop at the gym comes first. For others, it's two cups of coffee over the sports pages. In Olympia, teacher Kevin Head rises long before dawn on school days to go alone to a city park. There, his routine begins by asking the rampant ivy vines for forgiveness.
Thank you, Ivy, for your tenaciousness, your strength, and I ask you to let me take you out for the benefit of the world here.
And then Head leans down with gloved hands and rips and yanks as much ivy as he can slay for the next half hour. The 56-year-old works by the light of a single headlamp. Pretty much anything he grabs in this grove of big-leaf maples is bound to be ivy.
So ivy all through here, all down to the bay. All through the trees in there. You can
Head says he was inspired to action nearly 3 years ago by a guest speaker in his classroom. The topic was invasive plants.
I just said, well, I need to use some of my time to give service to the forest that I love and to bring back a little bit for the native plants and the native birds.
This task reminds me of the Greek myth about Sisyphus, the cruel king condemned for eternity to push a huge stone uphill, only to see it roll back down every time. Het says he relates more to the kid in The Star Thrower. That's a children's story in which a boy and his father come upon thousands of starfish washed ashore on a beach.
And the little boy takes the starfish and throws it into the water. And the dad says, why are you doing that? There's so many, it's not going to help. And the little boy says, well, it helped that one. And that's the idea.
Oregon and Washington classify English ivy as a lower priority noxious weed statewide, in part because eradication on a landscape scale just seems hopeless. Responsibility for combating ivy generally filters to the local level. Landowners in the Northwest typically take the approach described here by Silvana Niehauser. She's the City of Olympia's park ranger.
With English ivy, it's got a waxy property to the leaves, so spraying is not very effective at all. And you can't mow it because it's just a tangly mess. And so you're left with manual control by pulling it.
Niehauser figures it could take decades, if not a century, to pull all the ivy in Priest Point Park alone. That's the park where Kevin Head volunteers.
It can be overwhelming when you look at it overall.
But she says the battle is winnable when you set your sights on smaller plots and saving individual trees.
So we try to focus on prioritizing in large parks like this. And then in our small parks, we try to work on getting it completely eradicated.
Niehauser mostly relies on volunteers for ivy control because of staff cutbacks and tight budgets. Same story elsewhere in western Washington and western Oregon, where escaped ivy is pervasive. The infestation peters out as soon as you cross the Cascade Crest into the more arid inland Northwest. Oregon is home to one of the biggest and oldest anti-ivy campaigns in the country. Mary Verilli manages the No Ivy League, a program within the Portland Parks and Rec Department.
One other thing that stands out is how much square feet of ivy we've removed, and this is ivy from the ground, and it's been over 4 million square feet of ivy. And so it's really impressive to see these stats since 1994.
Which is when the No Ivy League started. The non-native vines have had a big head start. Botanical researchers believe English ivy was introduced to the Northwest by early settlers, probably before 1890. Super volunteer Kevin Head says he's committed to his ivy pulling routine at least until he retires later this decade. One thing that keeps him going is the pleasure of seeing native plants and birds return.
I can only get about 10 square feet a day, but it's thrilling to see it start to uncover.
I'm Tom Bonsi in Priest Point Park, Olympia.
And finally, with federal unemployment benefits just ended for more than 45,000 jobless Northwesterners, and as Congress acts to further slash food stamps, putting meals on the table is about to become even more of a challenge for many. One innovative community approach to hunger, founded in Southern Oregon, but now spread to Portland, Thurston County, Washington, and beyond, has reached an impressive milestone. As the story begins, we join a family who is among those who have made the Ashland Food Project a potent model of compassion in action.
I'm Paul Giancarlo.
And I'm Mary Schaefer.
We're about to go off on our Ashland Food Project food pickup. It's a big day today because we expect to hit the 1 million pound mark of food collected in Jackson County since we began in 2009. We go out every 2 months and go to our neighbors' homes and pick up a bag of food, which they are donating to the Ashland Emergency Food Bank. When they go shopping, they pick up an item of food and put it in their green bag, and then every 2 months we go around and pick it up for them, bring it to the food bank. So let's go do it.
All right, guys.
So, you know, I was thinking we could just go on down.
My name is Gabriel, and I'm 10, I guess.
My name's Rio, I'm 10. I live in Ashland, Oregon. We first started it like 5 years ago, and we just went around with a radio flyer that I don't think we have because it's like wheels broken off and stuff. It just went around our neighborhood.
Well, here we have a bunch of empty green bags with little red cards attached to each one, which thank people and also tell them when the next pickup is. So we leave everybody an empty bag when we pick up their full one. And if they're not there, we have a little note saying, sorry, we missed you, and give us a call if you want to donate. I'll just drive down the street here, and Mary and the boys will go on a treasure hunt. All right, you ready to start picking up, G?
Yep.
Okay. First time I've ever had to do this in the ice, in the snow. Rio, are you going to get this side?
Oh, no.
I'm going to pull up. Don't jump out until I stop.
You want to go up this side?
If they're not there, knock on the door. When you've been doing it long enough, you start to find out about what's going on in the neighborhood. And like this person here, her husband died about a year and a half back. And he was the one that handled getting the food ready for us. We knocked on the door and someone who we didn't know answered the door. And we said, we're here for the food pickup. And they said, oh, he died last week. Then someone came and said, no, he prepared the bag before he died. He prepared the bag. And, oh, my God, I was just in tears, you know, this.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Figgith.
And Karen Figgith.
Right from the get-go, we've been signed up and doing it. It's just such a good cause for the city. We know so many people that are struggling around here that need food so bad. So,
and that's what we're called to do by the Lord. They create the service. All we do is fill up the bag. They take it to the food bank, and it helps people. Yeah.
Yeah.
It puts the community back in touch with the fact that there are a lot of people who don't have enough, and that's how we got started with this, because my kids, who were five at the time, didn't really understand that there are some families that don't have enough food. They were amazed when they found that out.
Next one is 860 on the left.
8 what?
860.
When we started, we had three goals. One was to create a sustainable supply of food for the food bank. The second was building community. And the third was creating a model that could be used outside of Ashland, you know, so because we knew it was something that was a good idea. So we wanted to figure out how to do it and then try to pass it on to other communities. Hi, Len.
Thanks.
Merry Christmas, you guys. It started here in Ashland in 2009, and then in 2010, some people in Talent got one going there. And then I think a year later, Medford Food Project started. And then Eagle Point. I think there's 20 some communities now across the country that are doing it. Same thing, picking up on the same day.
I think the part of the process that you'll really enjoy is the food bank itself. You have volunteers from little ones to different people from different churches to the elderly, and it's like a beehive in there where everybody's figuring out, you know, how to sort the food and stock the shelves, and there's something about it that's pretty magical and very rewarding. I think you're in for a treat.
Hey, how you doing, Pat?
Oh my God, we're running out of food.
I'm Pam Marsh. I'm the manager here. So our job at the food bank is to collect food and then mainly to distribute it to folks who come in who are in need. So we were going for 41 years, and we were scraping around in food drives, largely holiday-oriented food drives, to fill the shelves. But then the Ashland Food Project started 4 years ago and really turned upside down our business model, essentially, because now we get food every 2 months from these wonderful food drives. It fills our shelves, and it gets us almost through 2 months, not quite. I mean, the demand has been growing over the past year. But were it not for the food project, I don't know what we'd be doing. We'd really be scraping around. We had a woman come in last week who said, thank God you're here. I've never been here before, but I had pneumonia. I missed a week of work, which meant she missed a week of wages. And my sister told me about this place. I don't know what I would have done. Now, we may never see that woman again, likely. And she's living paycheck to paycheck, but she's figured out how to make it. Or we may see her at another moment of crisis.
We want to congratulate this donor for delivering the 1 millionth pound collected in Jackson County since we started collecting food in 2009. To me, it feels really good because it's a way that my family and I can do something on a regular basis that is direct. I mean, the food that we're collecting today will be eaten tomorrow by somebody in our community. You know, it takes a lot of people to make it happen, and And that's what's so inspiring, is that it's many people doing a little to make a huge impact.
That unnarrated story was produced by Liam Moriarty. That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you join the show late, you can listen to a podcast of the show from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgain saying thanks for listening today. And listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.